Chapter 1, The Call of the Secret. At the present moment, the UFO is a true mystery. It is easier to say what it is not. Much of my thought of the dozen years past has been name-making and contemplation, closely guarded by the chaotically jeweled angels. Every angel is terrible, wrote Rilke. And at once sacred and profane, the UFO rises in my life as it may at some future point in human history. I have chosen a literary approach. The UFO is master of place and space, time and spirit, yet search for a simple form to convey this brought me to follow tradition, to write a chronological narrative. In early February of 1971, I was passing through southern Colombia on my way with my brother and friends to an expedition into Colombian Amazonas. Our route led us through Florencia, the provincial capital of the Departamento of Caquetá. There we paused a few days, awaiting an airplane to carry us to our embarkation point on the Rio Putumayo, a river whose vast expanse is the border between Colombia and her two southern neighbors, Ecuador and Peru. The day was especially hot, and we had left the oppressive confines of our hotel near the noisy central market and bus station. We walked southwest, out of town, perhaps a mile. Here were the warm waters of the Rio Acha, across rolling pastures of tall grass. After swimming in the river, playing in deep pools the warm torrent had carved in the black basaltic stream bed, we returned through the same meadows. One more familiar than I with the appearance of Stropharia cubensis pointed out a single large specimen standing tall and alone in an old bit of cow manure. Impulsively and at my companion's suggestion, I ate the whole mushroom. It all occupied but a moment, and then on we trudged, tired from our swim, a tropical thunderstorm moving toward us along the eastern edge of the Andean Cordillera, where Florencia is located. For perhaps a quarter hour we walked on, mostly in silence. Wearily I hung my head, almost hypnotized by the sight of the regular motion of my boots cutting through the grass. To align my back, to throw off my lethargy, I paused and stretched, scanning the horizon. The feeling of the bigness of the sky that I have come to associate with psilocybin rushed down on me there for the first time. I asked my friends to pause and sat down heavily on the ground. A silent thunder seemed to shake the air before me. Things stood out with a new presence and significance. It came like a wave and passed like a wave as the first fury of the tropical storm burst over us, leaving us soaked. In the sodden retreat, the brief moment preceding our frantic withdrawal went unmentioned by me. I recognized my experience as being induced by the mushroom, but I was involved, I thought, in a deep jungle search for hallucinogens of a different sort. Orally active DMT-containing drugs and yahe and its admixture plants. I filed the mushroom experience as something to look into another time. Longtime residents of Colombia assured me that the mushroom occurred exclusively on the dung of Cebu cattle, and I assumed that in the jungle of the interior, where I was shortly to be, I could expect no cattle or pasture. I put the thought of mushrooms from my mind as I anticipated the rigors of the Rio Putumayo descent toward our target destination, a remote mission called La Chorrera. Why had people like ourselves come to the steaming jungles of Amazonian Colombia? We were a party of five, bound by friendship, extravagant imagination, naivete, and a dedication to travel and exotic experience. Ev, our translator, was the only member of the group not long an acquaintance of us all. She was an American like ourselves who had lived several years in South America and had traveled in the East, where I had passed her once in the Kathmandu airport. Another story. In Colombia, she was recently free of a long relationship and fell in with our group, having nothing better to do. She and I were lovers of some 2 weeks when we arrived at La Chorrera. The other three members of our party, beside myself, were my brother, the youngest and least traveled of us, a student of botany and a colleague of long standing, Vanessa, an old school friend of mine from the Experimental College in Berkeley, trained in anthropology and photography and traveling on her own, and Dave, another old friend of mine, a gay meditator, a maker of pottery, an embroiderer of blue jeans, and like Vanessa, a New Yorker. As for myself, just 4 months before this trip, my brother and I had endured the grief of the death of our mother. Previous to that, I had been traveling 3 years in India and Indonesia, had worked in Japan and then in Canada, where we had all held a reunion and planned this Amazon expedition to investigate the depths of the psychedelic experience. I deliberately do not wish to say much about any of us. Let me say, though, that we were miseducated, perhaps, but well-educated, certainly. Our differences arose out of the faith that each had in his own ability to understand the situation correctly. Often these descriptions did not agree, as is a common enough situation among strong personalities or witnesses to an unusual event. We were complex people, or we would not have been doing what we were doing. None of us were yet 24 years old. We had been drawn together through the political turmoil that had characterized years shared in Berkeley. We had sorted the ideological options and had decided to put all of our chips on the exploration of the potential of the psychedelic experience as the shortest path to the sort of millennium that our radical politics had taught us to hope for. We had no very good idea at all about what to expect from the Amazon. We had collected as much ethnobotanical information as was available. This data told us where the various hallucinogens were to be sought, but not what to expect when we found them. I have given some thought to trying to reconstruct how predisposed we might have been to our eventual experiences. I find in a letter written 11 months before our expedition that Dennis was even then the person with the clearest conception. He wrote to me in China in May of 1970 to say, "As to the central shamanic quest and the idea that its resolution may entail physical death, indeed a sobering thought, I would be interested in hearing just how likely you consider this possibility and why. I had not thought of it in terms of death, though I have considered that it may well give us, as living men, willful access to the doorway the dead pass daily. This I consider to be a kind of hyperspatial astral projection that allows the hyperorgan, consciousness, to instantly manifest itself at any point in the space-time matrix, or at all points simultaneously. A UFO is essentially this hyperspatially mobile psychic vortex, and the trip may well involve contact with some race of hyperspatial dwellers. Probably it will be an encounter similar to a flying lesson, instruction in the use of the transdimensional stone, how to navigate in hyperspace, and perhaps an introductory course in cosmic ecology tending. Retention of the physical form under such circumstances would be, it seems, a matter of choice rather than a necessity, though it could be a matter of indifference, since in the hyperspatial web, all existing physical manifestations would be open. I would say that time is not of the essence for the venture, except insofar as the culture deaths of the tribes we are seeking are proceeding at an appalling rate."
Ah!
However colorful our fantasies, our operational interests specifically centered on DMT, dimethyltryptamine-type drugs, quite simply because their action, though very brief, seemed to us the most intense of the hallucinogens we knew. DMT is not an object of common experience, even among drug enthusiasts, and so a word must be said about it. It is a crystalline paste or powder in its pure synthetic form, and as such it is smoked in a glass pipe with no admixture. After a few lungfuls, the onset of the experience is rapid, 15 seconds to a minute. The hallucinogenic experience which it triggers lasts 3 to 7 minutes and is unambiguously intense. It is so bizarre and intense that even the most devoted aficionados of hallucinogens will usually pass it by. Yet, it is the commonest and the most widely distributed of the naturally occurring hallucinogens and is the basis, when not the entire component, of most aboriginally used hallucinogens in tropical South America. Naturally, as a product of plant metabolism, it never occurs in anything like the concentrations at which it comes from the laboratory. Yet, South American shamans, by predisposing themselves to its effects in various ways, do seek the same levels of reality-obliterating intensity achievable with pure DMT. Its strangeness and power so exceeds that of other hallucinogens that DMT seemed finally to define, for myself and my friends at any rate, the maximum exfoliation of the hallucinogenic dimension that can occur without serious risk to the organism. We thought, therefore, that our phenomenological description of the hallucinogenic dimension should begin by locating a strong DMT-containing aboriginal hallucinogen and then exploring with an open mind the shamanic states that it made accessible. To this end, we had sifted the literature on tryptamine drugs in the upper Amazon basin and learned that while yahe, or ayahuasca, the brew of Banisteriopsis caapi with the DMT admixture, is known over a wide area, just as are several kinds of DMT-containing snuffs, there was one DMT-containing hallucinogen that was severely restricted in its usage. Ukuhe is made from the resin of certain trees of the Myristicaceous genus Varola, mixed with the ashes of other plants and rolled into pellets. What caught our eye about the description of this drug was that the Witoto tribe, who alone knew the secret of it, used it to talk to little men and to gain knowledge from them. These little people are one bridge between the motifs of UFO contact and more traditional strange doings in the woods involving elves and fairies. The worldwide tradition of little people is well studied in the fairy faith in Celtic countries by W. E. Evans Vance, a book which was influential on Jacques Vallée's UFO quest as well as our own. The mention of little men rang a bell, since in Berkeley, in my own experience smoking synthesized DMT, there had been the impression of bursting into a space inhabited by merry, elf-like, self-transforming machine creatures. The sense of being literally in some other dimension which this experience provoked had been the focus of our decision to concentrate on tryptamine drugs. After sifting the literature of the tryptamine hallucinogens, we came eventually to Richard Schulte's paper, Varola as an orally administered hallucinogen. His description of the use of the resin of Varola theodora as an orally active DMT drug was fascinating. So too was the fact that the hallucinogen seemed to be limited in its use to a very small area. Schulte's was an inspiring voice when he wrote of Ukuhe, "Further field work in the original home region of these Indians will be necessary for a full understanding of this interesting hallucinogen, interest in this newly discovered hallucinogen does not lie wholly within the bounds of anthropology or ethnobotany. It bears very directly on certain pharmacological matters, and, when considered with the other plants with psychotomimetic properties due to tryptamines, this new oral drug poses problems which must now be faced and, if possible, toxicologically explained. Based on Schulte's report, we determined to go ourselves to the vicinity of La Chorrera to seek Ukuhe. To abandon our studies, whatever careers might be ahead of such opinionated psychoactivists, to pay our own way to the Amazon, to see if the titanically strange dimensions that we had encountered in DMT trance were even more accessible via the DMT drugs which the shamans of the Amazon had developed. It was of these drugs that I had been thinking when I had no time for the Stropharia mushroom encountered in the pasture near Florencia. I was eager to press on with the quest for the exotic, barely reported Witoto Ukuhe. Or did I imagine that the search for Ukuhe would soon after arrival at La Chorrera be all but forgotten in the discovery of the mushrooms so abundant there and the strange power that seemed to swirl around those foggy emerald pastures? First intimation of La Chorrera as a place different from other places came when we arrived at Puerto Leguizamo, our proposed point of embarkation down the Rio Putumayo. It is a place to be reached from Florencia and the rest of Colombia by airplane, as no roads make their way through the jungle to it. It is as tired and oppressive a South American river town as one could ever hope to see. William Burroughs passed this way in his search for Yahe in the 50s. He described it then as looking like some place after a flood. It has changed little. We were barely installed in our hotel and returned from the ritual registration of foreigners that goes on in the frontier areas of Colombia, when the matron of the hotel informed us that a countryman of ours was living nearby. It seemed incredible that an American could be living in such an out-of-the-way and thoroughly rural river town in Colombia. When La Señora remarked that this man, El Señor Brown, was very old and also a black man, it all became even more puzzling. My curiosity aroused, I left immediately in the company of one of the loutish sons of the hotel woman. New dimensions were added as we walked along. My guide could hardly wait for us to get out of the door of the hotel before informing me that the man we were to see was Mal Ibizarro. El Señor Brown es un sanguinero. Un sanguinero, he said. I did not believe it for a moment. The horror that the rubber boom brought to the Amazon Indians in the early years of this century has lived on. A memory for the oldest people and a terrifying legend for the younger Indians. In the area surrounding La Chorrera, the Huitoto population had been systematically reduced from 40,000 in 1905 to about 5,000 today. I could not imagine that the man I was to meet had any real connection with those distant events. I suppose that this story I was hearing meant that I was to meet a local boogeyman around whom extravagant stories had grown up. We shortly reached a ramshackle and indistinguished house with a small yard hidden behind a tall board fence. My companion knocked and yelled, and soon a young man, similar to my guide, came and opened the gate. My escort melted away and the gate closed behind me. A large pig lay in the lowest, wettest part of the yard. 3 steps up was a veranda. Upon the veranda, smiling and motioning forward, sat a very thin, very old, much wrinkled black man, John Brown. It is not often that one meets a living legend, and had I known more about the person I confronted, I would have been even more amazed than I was. "Yes," he said, "I am an American. Yes, hell yes, I'm old, 93 years old. Me history, baby, so long." He laughed dryly, like the rustle of roof thatch when tarantulas stir. The son of a slave, John Brown had left America in 1885, never to return. He had gone to Barbados and then to France. He had been a merchant seaman and had seen Aden and Bombay. Around 1910, he had come to Peru, to Iquitos. There, he had been made a work crew foreman in the notorious House of Arana, which was the main force behind the ruthless exploitation of the Indians of Amazonas during the rubber boom. "I spent several hours with El Señor Brown. He was an extraordinary person, at once near and yet ghostly and far away, a living bit of history. He had been the personal servant of Colonel Whiffen, who explored the La Chorrera area around 1912. John Brown is described in Whiffen's now rare book, Explorations of the Upper Amazon. John Brown was the last person to see the French explorer Jean Robuchon, who disappeared on the Rio Caquetá in 1913. "Yes, he had a big black dog that never left him," mused Brown. John Brown spoke Witoto, had lived with a Witoto woman for many years at one point. He knew the area into which we were going intimately. He had never heard of Ukuhe, but in 1915 he had taken Yahe for the first time, and at La Chorrera. His descriptions of his experience was an added inspiration to continue toward our chosen goal. It was only after I returned from the Amazon that I learned that it had been this same John Brown who had exposed the atrocities of the rubber barons in the Putumayo when Roger Casement, then the British consul in Rio de Janeiro, came to Peru to investigate the atrocity stories. It was John Brown who returned to London with Casement to give evidence to the Royal High Commission investigation. Jose Estacion Rivera, a Colombian historian, has told the story differently and implicates Brown in the murders, thus providing the basis for the Sanguinero story. I was impressed by Brown's sincerity, by the depth of his understanding of me, by the way that Roger Casement and a world nearly history, a world known to me only from its brief mention in the pages of Joyce's Ulysses, lived and moved before me in those long, rambling conversations on his veranda. He spoke long and eloquently of La Chorrera. He had not been there since 1935, but I was to find it much as he described it, the fever-haunted old town on the lowland across the lake no longer stands, but the dungeons for the Indian slaves can still be seen, crumbling iron rings set deep in sweating basaltic stone. The House of Arana is no more, and Peru long ago abandoned her rights to the area of Colombia. But the old town of La Chorrera is ghostly indeed, and so is the broad trail, or trocha, that we would shortly use to walk the 110 kilometers that separate La Chorrera from the Rio Putumayo. Up to 20,000 Indians gave their lives to push that trail through the jungle. Indians who refused to work had the bottoms of their feet and their buttocks removed by machete. Walking those gloomy, empty trails, one seems often to hear the grumble of voices or the rustle of chained feet. John Brown's rambling monologue prepared me for the strangeness, and on the morning that our boat was leaving to carry us downriver, We stopped at his house on our way to the landing. His eyes and skin shone. He was the gatekeeper of the platonic world downriver from Puerto Leguizamo, and he knew it. I felt like a child before him, and he knew that too. Bye-bye, babies. Bye-bye was his dry farewell.
Thank you.